Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Redford, Michigan, earned a BBA in International Marketing and Management from Northwood University. From 1993 to 2016, he was the founder and group managing director of Prism LTD. Since 2017, he's been the co-founder and managing partner of Fantastic, an app which allows fans to trade blockchain-based digital collectibles. One of the world's leading sport marketing experts, his name, Steve Madencia. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WGAR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to an amazing human being who's the co-founder and managing partner of Fantastic, Steve Madencia. Steve, welcome. An honor to have you.
Listen, it's my pleasure, Jack. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Let's go back to your days in Redford, Michigan. Talk about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please.
A unique situation, first of all. That little corner of Redford Township at 8 Mile and Grand River, where a little corner of Livonia, a little corner of Farmington Hills, banded together to form this wonderful community called Clarenceville. And Clarenceville is probably one of the oldest school districts in the state of Michigan. And still today, many of my friends are counted as people that I met as a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-old, 15-year-old in that Clarenceville district. My mother was a single mother, raising us in the 60s and the 70s, which is not an easy thing today, but very much so not an easy thing back then. She was working downtown at Detroit Medical Center as a medical technologist and taught us all along that knowledge is important. So education, education, education. Keep thinking about getting smarter.
Amazing job that she did. Amazing job that she did, huh?
She's a wonderful lady.
All right. You go to Northwood. Why did you pick Northwood?
Interestingly enough, at that time, a lot of my friends graduating from Livonia Clarenceville were picking Michigan State, Michigan, a variety of other schools. And I went with them on some of these journeys. Nothing wrong with those schools. Fabulous schools. Wonderful schools. But it seemed a little impersonal to me, the 300-person lecture rooms and stuff. And when I went to Northwood, I remember at the time, Dr. David Fry came out, introduced himself to me, and said, look around the campus, talk to anybody on the campus, talk to the students, talk to the janitors, talk to the professors, find out what this school is, and we think you'll like it. And in fact, he was 100% correct. It made me feel so welcome, so wonderful. Throughout the day, I spent 8 hours there. Midland, of course, is a beautiful city in the state of Michigan. And later that evening, as we had dinner before we departed Midland, happened to be David Fry entered the restaurant, and he remembered my name. He came across the room. Steve, how did you like your day at Northwood? Really want you there. And he really seemed sincere. And what Northwood did for me more than anything else was lit my entrepreneurial flame. It had been going at a lower level up to that point through some various things I tried as a youngster. But Northwood just really turned on that entrepreneurial flame for me.
David Fry was legendary, then Keith Pretty, legendary, and now Dr. Kent McDonald.
Exactly. We've been fortunate at Northwood to have some of the best leaders in that kind of entrepreneurial spirit area for all the women and men that attend the university.
In 1982, you were granted a BBA in International Marketing and Management, and Northwood has something they call fresh air.
Yeah.
Freedom, respect, empathy, spirituality, honesty, and then air, achievement, integrity, and responsibility. How do they live that, Steve?
Great question. It really comes down to each individual and having individual responsibility with this underlying aspect of fresh air to recognize that you have to, in each instance you come across, try to implore these skills, these characteristics, to make sure that you are the best person you can be in that situation. We've all been challenged with things in our lives. Jack, I know your background. You've been challenged with a lot of things. And if you can implore something along the lines of fresh air that quickly comes to your memory, it really helps you get the best out of the situation for everybody in that scenario. And that's what we tried to do throughout my time at Northwood and now my time as the vice chair of the Northwood University.
All right. We got to know each other the last couple of years through the Northwood OBL program that you've been the master of ceremonies, and you do a phenomenal job. What is the OBL program?
The Outstanding Business Leaders was actually started many years ago by Northwood founders. We're in our 44th year now, and essentially it's trying to recognize women and men of large enterprises, medium enterprises, and small enterprises that take that extra step to make an impact in their community, with their employees, in their business, so that they can be the example that Northwood would like people to show out there in the business world and that whole free enterprise system, to say this is a great person and how they run their business, how they run their lives, and you can learn something from them. And being an MC of this, you know, prestigious program is such an honor, quite frankly, number one. Number two is the most important thing for me is I take away a lesson from everybody that we, you know, have up there and talks to us and talks to our students. Our students say it's an accelerator for them in their knowledge of business, getting to know these people, understanding these people, and learning how to work with it.
All right, you say you learn from everybody that's up there. The people, the John Ricolta Juniors, are presented by a student presenter. And
yes.
A few months ago, we were at the Henry Ford Museum, and those student presenters outshined some of the honorees. Talk about the student presenters.
Well, it's a very competitive thing on campus, as you can imagine, to win one of those prestigious slots as a student presenter. And then you have to do your due diligence. You're assigned one of the honorees. You have to look into their background, understand it. You get the opportunity, whether in person or via Zoom call, to interview them and talk with them through their career, the ups and downs. You know, we don't want to hide anything. And then the students have to create and pull together a story. I remember a couple episodes ago, maybe almost a year ago, you were talking to Mitch Albom about, you know, great story writers of our time and things that make great story writers. And I was listening to that and thinking myself that that's what these students have, is they have that ability to piece together the right elements to captivate that audience at the Outstanding Business Leaders Awards, so that you really want to hear from John Ricolta Jr. as an example when he gets to stand up there and talk to everybody.
We're talking to Steve Mendencia. When we come back, we're going to find out that he got hired by Ford in kind of a unique area. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Steve Mendencia. Steve, you take a job with Ford in their Formula One racing team division.
Yeah, it was really interesting in this respect that back, you know, today, America knows quite a bit about Formula One. Back then, I like to say America couldn't even spell Formula One, right? And essentially, Ford were making a larger investment in the Benetton-owned Formula One team. And Benetton were getting more serious about their effort. Ford's engineering prowess was needed and required. But what they weren't sure of is, could Ford Mexico, Ford Italy, Ford Japan, Ford Australia, Ford Brazil leverage this investment in a correct way, in a proper way, to help with promotion and sales in their local markets and stuff. So as a young guy, not too long out of Northwood University, they asked me to conduct an audit. And I went around and spoke to the managing directors of each of these Ford entities around the world, and they were all seriously enthusiastic for the program. What they did show, though, was that they used it in a different way in every market. It wasn't consistent communications. So my recommendation to the Ford board of directors was, you need to put one person in charge. You need one person that can really control the messaging, control the activities, so that you get the maximum amount out of this sizable investment. And I remember CFO Alan Gilmore turning to me and saying, hey, young man, what about you? Why don't you go to Europe and be our eyes and ears in the Benetton team? And I was not necessarily a racing type, excuse me, or a racer by any means. But I loved the idea of business with sport mixed together. And so I took the assignment for 3 years, and it was eye-opening. It was wonderful. It was interesting working with so many different cultures and languages. And here's where my mother raising me, my mother could speak 10 languages fluently, with this kind of international mindset, really paid off because I was totally comfortable in this environment of Formula One, which is essentially a village of 10,000 people from 100-plus different countries coming together every 2 weeks at some part around the world, some different part. And so it was really, really interesting and a great assignment to get at an early age. And quite frankly, it was my doctorate degree in international sports marketing.
Okay, in America, NASCAR, Indy racing, they're kings. But for the rest of the world, Formula One blows that away. They're the kingfish outside America. Why so?
Well, it's interesting. It's the largest gathering in all 20-plus countries that they now race in of motoring and motorsport enthusiasts. And so you bring crowds like that together, and now with the added lifestyle element with the Netflix series Drive to Survive and more access that the consumers can now have when they go to races, it really does make it a big event. And so I would say, you know, round numbers, if you've got 300,000 people in Melbourne, Australia, at the Formula One race there that typically happens in March and kicks off the season, you probably have about 150,000 that are motorsport fans, maybe another 100,000 that are motoring fans that love cars and everything to do with cars and stuff like that. And then there's another 50 to 100,000 that are roughly those people that love to be at big events and have to be at big events and go to the parties and do the celebrations and get dressed up and yell and scream for their favorite driver. And so it really makes it an exciting atmosphere.
All right. Back in 2015, a 17-year-old kid became the youngest driver to compete in Formula One. His name is Max Verstappen. He's the 2021, the 2022, and the 2023, and soon to be the 2024 world champion. He races under the Dutch flag in Formula One for Red Bull Racing. Steve, when he doesn't win, it's like a shock.
Well, yeah.
How is he so good? What do they do?
Well, first of all, you have to go back even further than that. When I first met Max Verstappen, it was 10 years prior to the date you mentioned, when he was just a 7-year-old. And his father, whom I worked with, he was one of our Benetton Ford drivers, was bringing him around the paddock in Formula One. And you'd talk to this young man, and I mean, he was very, very young, and you would say, what do you want to do when you grow up, young man? I want to be a Formula One world champion. Not Formula One driver, not astronaut, not doctor, all these wonderful things. I want to be Formula One world champion. This kid was focused. Why was he so focused? A, his father was in the business, but B, what a lot of people don't understand, his mother was in the business. She was a great driver in her own right, quite frankly, all throughout Europe. And so together they brought this heritage and this driving discipline. And he right now, although I very much like him, I really like him, I think it's better for the sport if more people win, you know, if it's less predictable. Right now, he's just dominating, and so he needs to enjoy this time in his life because it won't last forever.
So, you know, Scotty Scheffler won 5 in a row that he entered tournaments, and his wife was pregnant, remember? And he said, hey, and whenever she's, you know, in labor, I'm leaving.
Yep.
And the other PGA kids, they were praying that the wife would go into pregnancy, into labor.
Exactly.
Okay. After a few years, Ford said, we don't want to do this anymore, Steve. So you start something called PRISM. What was it?
So PRISM was an acronym for Public Relations International Sports Marketing. My two passions, quite frankly. And we essentially took the learnings we had from Formula One, by the way, are instrumental for any company to learn how to work at that speed that every 2 weeks you need to be ready and prepared with something new and with your challengers right in your face. But we took that learning and we just applied it to all different areas, from Champions League football to Wimbledon to, we did a nice NASCAR program. We did an IndyCar program. And we would always represent brands and their investments that they had in sports and help them maximize that leverage around those activities that they had. So it was a really, really interesting time. We started off as an independent company, and then slowly we had WPP, who are at the time the world's largest conglomerate of advertising, marketing, PR agencies, come along and say, hey, we think you'd be better off as part of our group. And it took us a while to think about it, the leadership team and myself, about the pros and the cons of being part of a larger group. And ultimately, we said yes and became their first sports marketing group. And then through their network, we grew Prism quite quickly all around the world, because we would go, as an example, into China, and we'd have a client that would say, hey, I want you to get started next week. And we'd just go into the WPP ecosystem and say, we need 20 desks, 40 contracts, 20 people, 20 cell phones, and we need them next week. And they would have it all ready. And we could just worry about hiring the right people into our system and make it work in that respect. So it was very exciting to grow that company through the WPP network all around the world.
Steve, you're being a little humble. In 1992, you didn't need 40 desks. You and your wife, Jackie, started in a spare bedroom, probably with no desks, okay, while raising three kids. So
that's right. That's absolutely right. People forget about that. And it's you can never forget your beginning, right? I'll never forget I came from 8 Mile and Grand River. I'll never forget my friends. And no matter how important you might think you are yourself when you're in China and you're opening an office and you see 55 people hustling and running around, at the end of the day, you're a human being. And if you treat everybody else like a human being and remember your humble beginnings, you'll be okay. And I always reflect on what you mentioned there, Jack, as well. I always reflect on, we did start this, from our spare bedroom in our home. And I remember the first bill really hurt me badly, and it was $80, because I had to have a Mac guy come out and fix the Mac, and he found out that we just forgot to plug it in. And so that was our first bill. So, you just have to remember those things, right?
And then we just keep adding zeros.
Yeah. So,
okay, we're talking to Steve Medencia. When we come back, we're going to ask him, why did he sell the business to WPP in 1999? And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with Steve Medencia. In 1999, he sold his business, Prism, to WPP. Steve, why?
I wasn't really looking to sell. And what Martin Sorrell didn't know when he came calling was that I had another large New York-based advertising agency after us. And they had intellectually got myself and the leadership team to a point to understand that being part of a larger group, even though we were growing a phenomenal rate year in and year out, we could grow even faster globally with more clients if we were part of a larger group. So when Martin came along, he actually offered that. He said, look, we'll put you in charge of, you'll be our first sports marketing acquisition. We're going to make more around the world. We can help you grow in Asia Pacific. We were kind of stumbling and bumbling ourselves growing across Europe at that time. Europe in no way was the configuration and the openness that it is today under the European Union. So when we opened up in places like Greece and the Czech Republic and Poland and Hungary and Russia, it was very difficult to get all the legal hurdles done. Through WPP, we got it done easier. And we could see that, right? We could see that through them, we could move faster. And again, coming back to our Formula One teachings, we knew that moving with speed meant we could crush competition and stuff. So he quite frankly, made an offer that was too good to turn down. We took about, 3 days, the leadership team and I, to really stew it over and think about it and weigh the pros and cons. And we called him back and we accepted the offer. And it took about 3 months for the professionals that Martin had come and look through our books and our company and make sure everything added up to say, yes, this is a great company. Let's go for it. Let's make it happen. And so we did.
So you toiled in London for many years. and his name really is Sir Martin Sorrell, and
yep.
All of these iconic business leaders, et cetera, in England are Sir. Does Jackie call you Sir, or the kids call you Sir ever?
No. I don't think I would ever be comfortable and confident with that. And quite frankly, a lot of my close friends that I work with, like Martin, I hope I'm not insulting him. I always call him Martin. Jackie Stewart, as an example, is Sir Jackie Stewart. I always call him Jackie because I've known him for 40 years in the whole family. And it's difficult for me to change to call him something different. But I do notice that there are certain people that when they are honored that title by the prior queen or the king now, you know, they really, truly get into it full time and want to be called a sir all the time.
Yes.
That's not my cup of tea.
So that wouldn't fly at 8 Mile in Grand River, that's for sure.
No, I definitely know my clerical friends would never do that.
Okay, speaking of not flying, the vast majority of times when an entrepreneur sells his company to a big company, he leaves. Yet you stayed for 17 years with WPP. Why?
Yeah, interesting. If I wasn't challenged and if I wasn't doing what I was enjoying, I probably wouldn't have stayed 17 days, right? And the issue is, and you hit the nail on the head, Jack, when somebody buys your company, they give you enough money to say, go do anything you want to, including leave here tomorrow, you know, if you don't like things. And because one of my criteria for when they bought our company is I wanted to report directly into Sir Martin, which a lot of people warned me against. But I wanted to learn from him. I wanted to understand him. So as an example, within my first year of ownership, he bought the Y&R, Young and Rubicam, for roughly $3.4 billion using cash instruments like cash blowbacks, things I was not aware of, never heard of, had never dealt with. But it was interesting to watch him. This is kind of his opus in purchasing this thing. And so as long as I was learning and growing, going back to a lesson my mother taught me at an early age, I was happy with it. So when they put me in charge of, you know, all the sports marketing enterprises around the world, I'm learning and growing. When we built all the Asia Pacific offices in Bangkok and Beijing and Shanghai and Melbourne and Sydney, you know, those are things that I enjoyed. I'm really a 0-to-1 guy. And so I like building things from concept to, you know, something successful. And I'm okay running things, but it's not as exciting for me as it is when I want to go ahead and actually, you know, build something from scratch.
All right. You watched WPP and Martin Sorrell buy, you know, one acquisition after another.
Yep.
That's the easy part, writing the check, signing the 300 pages of documentation that the accountants and the lawyers have. The much harder thing, Steve, is bringing these two disparate families together. So you, how talk about what's the keys to making that happen?
It's really, really an interesting point, Jack, because the last thing you want to do if you're acquired is lose the culture of your business. And we had a culture in our business at Prism that really meant that people loved working with us because they knew that we were going to make it happen for them and get it on. If we all of a sudden became bureaucrats and had to be in too many WPP meetings about why depreciation was down 2% in August of last year or something, it would just kill the soul of our company. And so we really had to play the game right to be close enough to the center to get some benefits out of it, but not so close that we started to take on their culture, which was a culture of, you know, administration, because that's what they were. They were, as you correctly said, buying companies, selling companies, pulling companies together and stuff like that. And so you had to kind of ride that wave, that fine balance of keeping your own company culture, but using the benefits of the big home office as well, when and however you could.
All right. If you want to learn more about WPP, it's www.wpp.com. All right. 2019, you decide to leave. Well, you leave in 2017. And you start a company, Fantastic, Fantastec.
Yep.
What does Fantastic do?
Well, my business partner and I had this idea of about 3 or 4 different ideas that we felt could use new technologies to help digital fans, distance fans, get closer to the sports that they love and that they want to be near and dear to their hearts. And the best example I kept giving was my beloved Detroit sports teams of the Lions and the Tigers and the Red Wings and the Pistons, right? How could I get closer to them when I have a London base? How could I feel part and parcel of it? And so there's a lot of tools that are out there, and it goes beyond Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and stuff like that. It goes beyond a post and liking a post. And one of the real benefits of being part of WPP, if I take a half a step back, is we saw all the consumer data that was coming in, and they had oodles and oodles of consumer data. And consumers were basically getting frustrated. You can tell it today, it's easy to say, but back then you could see that just liking and sharing a post wasn't enough from their favorite sports team. They really wanted to have better integration. And so my business partner and I said, what are those things that we can create, that we can develop to make a fan feel closer, feel better, feel more part and parcel of their team when they're a distanced fan?
We're talking to Steve Medencia. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk about Fantastic. I remember, Steve, back in my day, I would take my baseball cards in a shoebox to school and trade. That was the old way. That was the old way. So. And I'm Jack Crusoe, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Krasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol. I'm Jack Crusoe. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Steve Medencia. Steve, the only constant in life is change.
Right.
And with COVID, and then in college sports, the transfer portal, and now name, image, likeness, how has that changed the landscape?
Well, very interesting, Jack, because our company that my business partner Simon started in England initially worked with European football clubs, Arsenal, Real Madrid, Borussia Dortmund, as our partners to help us develop this new technology to get them closer to their international fans that would not attend matches at their home game. Then I had a couple of athletic directors in America that I know quite well from working in the industry call me and say, look, we think that's very intriguing what you're doing. Could you help us out? Because our particular problem is, not do we have to just take care of the quarterback and the star basketball players on the women's and men's team. We have 800-plus student-athletes that we need to look after. And we need people that are skilled and capable of doing, you know, digital collectibles, that they can do that at scale. And it looks like you're doing that at scale for these European football clubs. It's tough to turn it down because, again, growing up in the state of Michigan, I love Michigan sports. I'm a big, you know, Michigan fan. I like Michigan State basketball. Tom Izzo, classy guy, you know, so I'm like, okay, we can help these guys. Let's go in there. So I flew over. I met with the athletic departments. They're all very engaging, very professional. The wild card in the whole thing was this new name, image, and likeness. Not one single solitary person could tell you exactly how it was going to play out. And it was interesting, very, very interesting, because we did something a little bit deeper. We actually went on campus and we went into the classrooms and we started working with the sports management classrooms to say, how can we take this new product that nobody knows anything about, and here's the data, and here's the insights, and here's the information, and make it work on your campus? And it's when you have, you know, standing in front of your classroom, I'll give you an example at Michigan. They had Blake Corum. He was in the class, and he had some really good ideas. Very sharp young man, very professional, sharp young man. And Zach Zinter as well. And these guys were saying, look, this is what we think you should do. This is what we think you should try. And so we would implement these programs across campuses. And I also remember being on campus at Syracuse, where We had some great professors that were actually teaching name, image, and likeness in their classroom, were teaching game technology in their classroom, helping us. And so we had this really incredible, wonderful rise. And we rode that wave and raised money against it and stuff like that. And probably the most important thing is we had data feeding us that was really sound data that said, this is going to work. This is great. This is wonderful. And then at a certain peak, at a certain point, that data turned against us. And I said to the guys, why aren't you still talking so strongly about the data? And they were like, well, we don't think you're going to like this data. Look, the data is the data. Let's deal with it, you know? And the data was predicting that not only would there be a downturn in the sector, but a sharp downturn. So we watched it very closely and talked with our shareholders and our partners about it and stuff. And ultimately, the bottom fell out on the digital collectibles market. Now, I think there was a lot of different reasons why that happened. But at the end of the day, you have to say, okay, will it recover? Because I've been in markets that have gone down, gone backwards, and they've recovered. And, you know, you put plans together. We've survived 2008 with my sports marketing firm, you know, came out stronger. So what we did is we said, okay, let's put together the most optimum plan that we feel for September 2023 and October 2023 and see what we can do over those 60 days. And quite frankly, the market just kept spiraling down that we thought, you know what, this is not going to recover in 18 months or 24 months. So I went to my shareholders and I said, I think the reasonable thing to do at this point in time, quite frankly, is to withdraw from the market. I know we have other tools and I know we have funding to be able to keep going, but you know, we need to do these things properly and correctly. And it was a tough decision, a very difficult decision. So many good people, so many great people helping us, both at the collegiate level, you know, student athletes, wonderful to work with, so much easier to work with, as you can imagine, than European football stars, soccer stars. And so we made that tough decision. And it may come back in 24 months or 36 months, but it wasn't for us. And so we took that technology that we were really leaders in, which was doing it off of your mobile phone. Anybody else that was kind of close to us were all desktop. We were the first and the only ones for a long time to do it off the mobile phone. And we sold that technology on and moved on. And now, you know, this is one of the reasons I'm in Los Angeles talking to you today. I'm meeting with a lot of tech firms, just talking about how we can use our sports business expertise to help them grow their technology in these sectors.
All right, let's change subject. Entrepreneurship. You are a quintessential entrepreneur. What is an entrepreneur?
I think it's a person that is not afraid of the negatives or the downside, right? So you have to always be challenged. I think it's a person that sees a vision of connecting a certain number of dots that people may see 2 out of 3 dots or 1 out of 3 dots, but they don't necessarily see all 3 dots. And the entrepreneur will connect those 3 dots that others don't see and take the risk. And risk, remember, there's upside and downside. And, you know, I'm fortunate that I've had mostly upside in my career, but there's also been downside, as I just mentioned, fantastic, making the tough choice to close that operation. But the entrepreneur is not afraid of taking that risk. And a lot of people misunderstand that when, you know, they could get mad at, say, Jeff Bezos at Amazon for all the money he's making. At one point, he took a huge, huge risk, right? And that's probably my definition of an entrepreneur.
All right, I quote you now. My 2 golden entrepreneurial rules are 1, learn from everyone, and 2, help others. Steve, that's not going to work today.
Well, I'd go in the face of that, and I'd say try to. Try. In fact, interestingly enough, while I'm out here in L.A., I met with a young lady who was trying to get into the motorsport business. I did not know her, only through a mutual friend, and I said, look, next time I'm in Los Angeles, I will sit down with you and I'll have a cup of coffee with you and I'll give you all of my insight, all of my expertise that I have learned to date to see if that can help accelerate you. I think we owe it to people. I was very fortunate that I had people in my career when I was younger and still today, quite frankly, that are not afraid to open their doors and open their minds to me. And I think we all need to keep doing that, Jack. In fact, I think that's what your, you know, interviews do with all the variety of people that you've had on your interview sessions. They've helped people.
All right. Entrepreneurs believe that success is the journey, not the destination. Talk about that.
Yeah, interesting. I would say more that enjoyment is the journey, not the destination, right? So, yes, you may achieve success, and that'll bring you other opportunities, but it's that journey along the way when things are unknown, when you have to overcome obstacles. I often draw a line of one of my first enterprises that we talked about earlier, Prism, that went from basically zero to 100, but it was not a straight line from zero to 100. There were a lot of dips and a lot of dives that we as a team had to build out of and drive out of and think out of and work out of. And I think the journey part of it is what brought me closer to all of the people that worked together as part of that team than any success we may have had at the end game.
We're talking to Steve Matencia, and he is a lifelong knowledge seeker. Steve, today, people have to keep learning while they're earning. The only constant in life is change. Some people run to the change. Others try to avoid the change. Talk about the mindset of running to the change, embracing the change.
Great perspective. And I think this actually goes back to my high school days at Livonia Clarenceville, when I was not necessarily the best player on the basketball team or the football team. But in the last 2 minutes, when that change was going to happen in the score, I always somehow ended up with the ball. People wanted to give me the ball. And I think that that's because I enjoyed those challenges. I enjoyed turning those situations into our favor and making success with that. So I did run to the change, as you described. And I find now, later in life, as I've run businesses around the world and had different teams, that I also run to those change. People will always be with challenges, but it's how you tackle those challenges, how you go forward with those challenges that really makes you, I believe, a true entrepreneur.
We've been talking to Steve Matencia, whose two golden rules, entrepreneurial rules, learn from everyone, help others, and that's what the man does. Steve, thank you very much.
Jack, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for everything you do at WCLC.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.